Today is Thursday, November 9th. We're going to be talking about urinary system information again today. Okay, so on Tuesday we talked about glomerular filtration. We talked a little bit about tubular reabsorption, but I want to go back and just hit this from the beginning for you. So when we're thinking about filtering blood, we have to consider the parts of the nephron to understand where this occurs. The nephron has a set of capillaries that are built for filtration. And what are those capillaries called? Glomerulus, yeah. So those glomerular capillaries or glomerulus, that's the site of filtration. And thinking back to when we discussed blood vessels, we know that we have to have a pressure high enough to force the fluids out of the capillary. Now, here's the catch. We don't want to reabsorb at the same time that we're doing filtration. We want reabsorption to occur later on in the tubule system. So for now, we're just going to focus on how we can force fluids out of the capillary. There's actually three pressures playing a role here, not just two as we saw with the capillaries in our systemic flow. The three pressures that play a role is good old hydrostatic pressure, or BHP, okay, and we've also got osmotic pressure, or BOP. So those two are the same old that we discussed way back in the blood vessel chapter. And there's a new one here for us. It's called capsular hydrostatic pressure, and that's created by the fluids in the capsule that are pushing their way back into those glomerular capillaries. Well, of these three pressures, which one is responsible for pushing fluids out of the capillary?
BHP,
good. And the other two, osmotic pressure and capsular, they're actually fighting against that hydrostatic pressure. So when all is said and done and you get done with the battle of pressures, the overall net filtration pressure here in the glomerular capillaries is what?
10,
right. So all this big battle is going on, and we're only forcing fluids out with a measly 10 millimeters mercury of pressure. Let's see, in class, go ahead, Ashley. Sure.
Airflow.
I know, it's awful. Have to bring a change of clothes just for this room, you know. Let's see, on Tuesday, we talked about the JGA cells. They are situated right here between the efferent and afferent arterioles, and they're snug up against this piece of the DCT. So when those JGA cells detect low blood pressure, they release a chemical called renin. Good. This turns on a mechanism called the renin-angiotensin mechanism. And renin travels next to the liver and tells it to release angiotensin 1, good. And you convert to angiotensin 2 using
ACE,
good. And that enzyme converts us to a more potent form of a vasoconstrictor. So angiotensin 2 comes to your afferent arteriole and gives it a good squeeze. How does that help us if our problem is low blood pressure? Increases blood pressure. Yeah, so it squeezes the efferent arteriole. That backs up blood flow into the glomerular capillaries, and it allows for us to increase pressure to the point that we can still remove toxins and filtrate from the bloodstream. Okay, angiotensin 2 also encourages the release of two hormones. Those two?
Aldosterone
and ADH. Good. And one of those encourages sodium reabsorption, aldosterone, and ADH encourages
water.
Good. So together, those two will increase your blood volume and your blood pressure. Okay, so that allows us to continue making filtrate even if we happen to have a low net filtration pressure or NFP. All right, so that was the gist of what we covered in here on Tuesday from page 106. Do y'all have any questions there? So let me talk to you about terminology for fluids. When we talk about fluids in the bloodstream, we call it blood plasma, okay? When we talk about fluids inside a cell, we call it intracellular fluid. In between cells and tissues, we call it interstitial fluid. You know, if the fluid is in the lymphatic system, we call it lymph. Well, we've got a name for those fluids and electrolytes in the kidneys, and when the fluids are in the nephron tube, we have a name for it. It's called filtrate. Okay, so what we squeeze out of those capillaries in the glomerulus and capture by that Bowman's capsule, that fluid and electrolyte mixture is called filtrate. Now, we're going to reclaim 99% of what we filter back into the bloodstream. So we're not going to let but 1% of these fluids and electrolytes go into our urine. So I kind of have a mental image of tubular reabsorption working like this. You know, at the end of the semester, you take your book bag, you're done with the semester. You may have gum wrappers, broken pencils, wadded up pieces of paper, all that stuff stuck in your book bag. And at the end of the term, you may just dump your book bag on the floor and get everything out. And then you say, okay, this stuff here is garbage. I'm not going to put this back in my book bag. But, you know, these good pencils, I'll probably keep those. I'll stick them back in my bag. And you're sorting basically trash versus what you want to keep. So that's what we did at the filtration process. We took out stuff from the bloodstream. We dumped our book bag, so to speak. And once we moved to tubular reabsorption, we're saying, you know, hey, that's a good pencil. I'll take that back and I'll keep it. And, you know, that's a good bottle of water. It hasn't been opened yet. I'll keep that. And that gum hasn't been chewed yet. I'll keep that. And so what you end up doing is you sort the good and keep that, and then you discard what you no longer want to keep. Tubular reabsorption is going to move these wanted items back into the bloodstream. And this network of capillaries that wraps your nephron is where we're going to move them. What are those capillaries called? Good, peritubular capillaries. So whatever you want to reabsorb, whatever you want to keep, you're going to move back into those peritubular capillaries. So the stuff that we're sorting through is in the PCT currently. And if you decide, your body decides, hey, this is garbage, I don't want to keep this, then what happens to those items that are unwanted?
They go out the body.
They go out the body, yeah. So if you filter something, let's say you filter some ions that you don't want to keep. Maybe you've got some excess sodium. Those sodiums get filtered at the glomerular capillaries. They get released into the PCT. And if you don't ever reabsorb them, they keep traveling through the loop of Henle, the DCT. They hit this collecting duct, and then where do they go? Go out through
urine.
Yeah, so that whole pathway that takes you through minor calyces, major calyces, renal pelvis, you just dump that stuff into the urine, and so it's removed from the body. So we want to appreciate here that if you are keeping stuff, you're putting it back in the bloodstream via the peritubular capillaries, versus items that you want to discard, you may let those items be filtered and then not reabsorbed. You'll just let them travel on in the urine pathway. Okay, so what we were talking about in here on Tuesday were some of the items that you may want to keep. And looking at the list here, these are all things that play a very useful role in our bodies. You know, we talk about sodium playing a role in osmosis, driving fluid movements. We also know that sodium is important for maintaining membranes polarity, like say for muscles and nerves. Why is glucose important to reclaim? ATP, yeah, got to make ATP with it. So we reclaim up to 180 units. That is what we consider to be our transport maximum. Now, if your filtrate contains more than 180 units, what happens to all the units above 180?
They go out in the urine.
They go out in the urine, right. So you can only keep up to 180 units. You may have heard that blood glucose levels at fasting should be around 70 to 120 units. So 180 gives us a little extra sugar above and beyond what our fasting level should be. Chlorine is a big buddy of sodium. In fact, chlorine follows sodium back into the bloodstream. And bicarbonate ions are actually going to help make our blood more alkaline if necessary. And your kidneys can make more bicarbonates if needed. I do want to mention that glucose, chlorine, bicarbonates, all are coupled with sodium reabsorption. So what does that mean that they are coupled?
They follow it.
Yeah, so sodium's kind of like the ringleader, and if sodium gets reabsorbed, glucose, chlorine, and bicarbonate follow along. So it's, you know, going to encourage the absorption of those items. So just thinking a little bit more about bicarbonate here, we know that bicarbonate behaves as a base, and if you reabsorb more bicarbonate back into the bloodstream, your bloodstream becomes more basic or alkaline. So this is what we think about in terms of acid-base balance. Under what conditions might you want to keep more bicarbonates?
Your blood's acidic.
Your blood's acidic, good. So if you have a patient who is, say, experiencing emphysema, what do people with emphysema tend to retain? Carbon dioxide, yes, CO2. What impact does excess CO2 have on your bloodstream? Makes it more acidic, yeah. And you can't really say, if you're the respiratory center, to the lungs, hey, exhale faster, because that patient can't really get rid of all that excess CO2. So yeah, if you've got, say, lung issues, respiratory disorders, then if you've got acidosis, you can make your blood more alkaline by balancing it with increased absorption of bicarbonate ions. So we're kind of getting back into that acid-base discussion once again.
And that's when the buffer system, right?
Yeah, that's...
Okay, you got to release from that.
Yeah, because that that whole equation that we covered, yeah, that's that thing.
The buffer system.
Ringing a bell? Okay, so we know that carbon dioxide is managed by your respiratory system, and we know that hydrogens and bicarbs can be managed by your urinary system. Relationship between the left side and the right side of the equation back and forth and help to manage blood pH. So, you know, we can exhale out more CO2s, and if we can't do that, we can get rid of more hydrogens and encourage more bicarbonates to be reabsorbed. Okay. All right, so we can also encourage water reabsorption here. We actually call it obligatory water reabsorption. And what this means is, about, say, 60 to 70% of the fluids that you retain in the kidney are done so just to take it back, whether or not you need it. So we are going to reclaim a certain amount of sodium and a certain amount of water, whether or not your body actually needs those items reclaimed. Finally, we've got amino acids there. They are not coupled with sodium. What do amino acids help us build? Proteins, good. Okay, so what we're talking about right now is called tubular reabsorption. These are items in your filtrate traveling through your PCT that we want to keep. And because we want to keep these items, we move them from your PCT back into the peritubular capillaries. And these items rejoin blood flow. So let's take, say, sodium for instance. When sodium comes through your arterial pathway, it gets filtered by your glomerulus. It is now removed from the bloodstream, and it enters what is called filtrate traveling through your tubule system. When we get to the PCT, if we decide that we want to keep some of that sodium, we move that sodium from the PCT into the peritubular capillaries. All right, from there, we travel to a venule, to a cortical radiate vein. Where do you go next?
Arcuate
vein, good. Into the lobar vein and the renal vein, right. So ultimately, these items that you want to reabsorb, they are meant to be returned to the blood flow. And the way you get them there is to move them from the PCT into the peritubular capillaries. Okay, so let's check our page 105 list of tracings. Looks like we can hit number 3 and number 4 with our discussion right now. Let's take number 3. Let's take blood flow. Okay, so for number 3, if you're tracing a bicarbonate ion, we're going to start with the renal artery. We'll take it from the renal artery to the segmental artery, interlobar artery, arcuate artery. Good. 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 Great. Okay. So for the bicarbonate tracing, this is the first half. Take it from the renal artery to the glomerulus.
You forgot the
efferent
arterial
after the glomerulus. We're not going there. Yeah, we're going to filter it out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So for number 3, bicarbonate ion, we're going to filter out that bicarbonate. So this is first half of that tracing. We're going to take it from the renal artery to the glomerulus. Awful hot, yeah.
What's going on?
You know, we call, we'll say it's too hot, they'll come fix it, and then it'll be 60 degrees. We call and we say it's too cold. There's an old HVAC system in here, and the two sides of the building don't operate equally, so. Yeah. And actually, our heat and air conditioning comes from a compressor that's sitting outside the 200 building.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. If you happen to walk that way, you may see a huge compressor out back. Yeah, that's what funnels to us. Yeah. I'm waiting till y'all copy, then I'll switch. Everybody good with this screen? Okay. So at the glomerulus, you filter out this bicarbonate. It gets captured by the Bowman's capsule. And from the Bowman's capsule, we travel into the PCT. Okay, so after glomerulus, we have the Bowman's capsule. From the Bowman's capsule, we move to the PCT. Okay, and if you look at the top of page 107, third bullet point down on 107, it says, once reabsorbed, and there's the rest of your tracing. From the PCT, we head back into the peritubular capillaries all the way to the renal vein.
That's the whole
thing. Yes, so from renal artery to glomerulus, Bowman's capsule, and then PCT to renal vein.
So when you say filter, the body is keeping, correct?
Yeah, these are items the body.
When you say it's secreted, it's trying to make urine, right?
Yeah, if it's secreted, it's going to be in urine. And if you don't reabsorb, it's going to be urine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so from the top, bicarbonates travel from the renal artery, segmental artery, arcuate artery, sorry, interlobar, yep, then arcuate, and then cortical radiate, afferent arteriole, glomerulus. What's next?
Bowman's capsule.
Bowman's capsule, PCT. I'll take Bowman's capsule or not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't have to put Bowman's unless you just remember to put it in there. So from glomerulus, we head to the PCT.
Peritubular capillaries.
Veins. Good.
The
cortical radiate vein.
The
arcuate vein. Bingo, you got it. Good. No, because if you think about the image of it, how it goes, it makes better sense. Yeah.
So the peritubules are made for reabsorption.
Yes.
And I'm trying to figure out the difference between the glomerulus capillaries and the peritubular capillaries.
Yeah, the filtration is glomerulus, and reabsorption and secretion is the peritubular capillaries. There's no exchange, it's just filtering. In the glomerulus, in the peritubular capillaries, you're reabsorbing and you're also secreting, but they're two different processes. They're kind of opposite.
Does it matter if we call the collecting duct the collecting tubule?
Oh, either one's fine. Yeah. Let's hit that number four tracing on page 105. This time you've got a pathway of sodium ions. They are filtered, but they're not reabsorbed. So, what do you think we're going to do when we get to the glomerulus? What happens to those sodiums at the glomerulus? They're filtered, right? Okay, so they're removed from the bloodstream at the glomerulus. They're captured by the Bowman's capsule. And
this time they go down to the...
Yeah. Take them to the PCT and then let them continue going in the tubule system. So this time, if you flip back with me to page 103, after you travel from PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, collecting duct, there's where you pick up. Urine now drips from the tips of those renal pyramids. We travel minors, major calyces, renal pelvis, and on out to the urethra.
So you start from DCT?
Actually start from the renal artery, okay, because we're going to take it from the renal artery to the glomerulus, and we'll filter it there.
Number four.
Yeah, that's number four. So take me from renal artery to the glomerulus. Well, you got to add from the glomerulus to the PCT, to the loop of Henle, the DCT, collecting duct, and then take back to 103 at the bottom. Okay, so for number four, we're going to filter those sodiums. We're not going to reabsorb them. We will start with renal artery, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, cortical radiate artery, travel to the afferent arteriole. We're filtered at the glomerulus. And then let's go to this picture because we now travel PCT, loop of Henle.
Do we have to say whether or not that there's something with these sodiums?
You don't have to. You can just tell me loop, and that's okay. Okay, so PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, collecting duct.
Minor calyces.
Good. Minor calyces.
Major calyces.
Good.
Pelvis. and pelvis.
Good. I said, okay, so minors, majors, renal, pelvis, ureter,
bladder, and urethra. The papillary, we don't say that?
You can tell me the papillary duct if you want.
Oh, okay.
I like
to
do the renal papillary.
You can put it in there.
Okay.
I'll take.
That way it starts dripping it, right?
Yeah, I'll take extra. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'll picture that right there.
Yeah, and that little duct right there. Yeah.
And papillary, if I'm dripping into
it, yeah.
So that's what got me. I just want to make sure you're not missing it. So you just go from the collected duct to the minor.
You can. If you want to put that papillary duct, you're welcome to.
Okay.
If it's already in your head for lab, then don't take it out.
Okay.
Ashley. We will, but we're not there yet, so when we get to secretion in a minute, we'll come back to it. Okay. Are you guys good with numbers 3 and 4? Okay. Down at the bottom of page 107, let me mention to you about the countercurrent multiplication process that's going on in that loop of Henle. Okay, so what we're doing is we're moving filtrate, stuff that's been removed from your bloodstream, through this renal tubule system. We've taken back items that we need, or actually items that we're just going to reclaim whether or not we need them here in the PCT. And once you move to this nephron loop, we are now looking at having moved a bunch of water and sodium back into the bloodstream. So this is an opportunity for us in the loop of Henle to adjust for the saltiness of this filtrate, because if your filtrate is too salty, what's the water in the filtrate going to do?
Ball
the salt. If your filtrate is not salty enough, what happens to the water? Yeah, it may move into the bloodstream instead of staying in the filtrate, yeah. So what we want to do is make sure that we don't get too much salt and water in the bloodstream or too little salt and water in the bloodstream. So what we're trying to do is make this an ideal situation. We want to make your saltiness similar to what your blood is going to be. So at this point, we adjust the saltiness of the filtrate traveling through your nephron loop. This process is called countercurrent multiplication, because we don't let water follow salt this time. We let water be reabsorbed separately, and then we let salt get reabsorbed separately. That way, we don't have this mess of water always wanting to follow salt. So you'll notice that going down the descending limb of the nephron loop, we're going to reabsorb water only. And heading up the ascending limb of the nephron loop, we only reabsorb sodium and chlorine. I'll tell you an easy way to keep this straight. If you think about waterfalls, you know, an actual waterfall in the mountain, yeah, water falls down. And so as you're going down the descending limb, that's when you reabsorb water. The reason we call this countercurrent multiplication is because we're moving fluids and salts in basically opposite directions. Sodium is going to be reabsorbed on the upswing, while water is reabsorbed on the downswing. So, you know, we're thinking of moving against the current that's countercurrent, and the multiplication part is about adjusting the salinity or saltiness of the filtrate moving through the nephron tube. You doing so far so good? Okay, so one more opportunity for reabsorption occurs in the DCT, and this reabsorption is largely hormonal driven. So we've talked about aldosterone, we've talked about ADH, and now we're going to use them in our discussion with this nephron tube. So over here in the DCT, we're still doing tubular reabsorption. You know, but we're really looking this time at it being a hormonal-driven process. So the first hormone listed there, and we're going to have to flip the page, of course, over to 108. First hormone listed there is going to be aldosterone that drives the reabsorption of sodium. Under what conditions might you need aldosterone?
Low blood pressure.
So if you've got low blood pressure, then aldosterone is released. It will target your DCT and insert sodium channels. And of course, sodium is going to be reabsorbed back into the bloodstream if aldosterone is present. You'll notice in the notes column on the far right, there are some items that can inhibit sodium reabsorption and interfere with, say, you know, aldosterone's activities. There are some medications like, say, diuretics that inhibit sodium reabsorption here. There are certain diuretics that act on the nephron loop. They're called loop diuretics. Other diuretics may interfere with, say, aldosterone's role, and we call those ACE inhibitors. So there are many kinds of medications that can kind of play a role as a diuretic, and some of those may in fact interfere with sodium reabsorption here in the DCT. Caffeine also interferes with sodium reabsorption, so instead of reabsorbing the sodium back in the bloodstream, what happens to that sodium in the filtrate?
Goes out,
yep, so it becomes urine, okay? We've also got alcohol. Alcohol inhibits antidiuretic hormone. And again, it also acts as a diuretic because we urinate out fluids that we should be keeping. So let's hit ADH next. We know ADH normally drives water reabsorption in the DCT. So why might you want to keep more water? What might be wrong?
Dehydration.
So if you're thirsty, if you're dehydrated, if you're too salty, you may need to keep more water, and that's where ADH plays a role. So ADH drives water reabsorption, while sodium is going to specifically drive that sodium reabsorption. One more here is parathyroid hormone. We've talked about this one way back in the first part of this course. What electrolyte or ion does it help to regulate?
Calcium,
good. So if you have low blood calcium levels, we may encourage more calcium reabsorption. That will help us to maintain calcium for muscle and nerve functions. Yeah, good. Everybody get a chance to sign in. Okay. So let's go back and look at some of our issues here. We've talked about alcohol inhibiting water reabsorption. Caffeine and certain diuretics can inhibit sodium reabsorption. And then finally, we've talked about glucose before. What is that transport maximum number for glucose?
180,
yeah. So if you have excess glucose being dumped into the filtrate, you can only reabsorb 180 units back in the bloodstream. Anything in excess ends up staying in the filtrate, and water not only follows salt, but water will also follow sugar. So the water may, in fact, hang out with this sugar, be excreted in your urine, and unfortunately, that leads to dehydration, since we're talking about water exiting the body instead of getting reabsorbed. That's exactly right. Yep, so it drives the thirst, it drives the urination issue, it drives the sugar in the urine. So, yeah, unfortunately, that drives all the three cardinal signs of diabetes. Yep.
So, glucose can inhibit it. just water, so that's still got to deal with ADHD as well?
It's not necessarily going to work in favor of ADHD. It's not working against it either. Mm-hmm. It's just making the water come with the glucose rather than follow the water channels back in.
Okay.
So glucose is kind of like the Pied Piper that says, hey, water, you're coming with me out in the urine.
Oh, because water follows sugar. As okay,
that's right. Yep.
I got you.
Okay. Okay, just a couple of things to think about and appreciate. If you've got ADH in control of your kidneys, then ADH is telling your kidneys to reabsorb more what?
Water.
Good. So if ADH is in control of you and you reabsorb more water, that means there's less water exiting your body in the urine. So what color will the urine be?
Dark yellow.
For when you're dehydrated.
Okay.
Yep. So if you're dehydrated and ADH causes your kidneys to reclaim more water, your urine will be dark yellow, very concentrated, small amounts. Okay. If you're well hydrated, do you need ADH?
No.
No. And if you don't need ADH, then what happens to the water traveling through the DCT?
It goes out.
And the urine this time is what color?
It's lighter yellow.
Lighter yellow. Okay. And do you have a lot or little? You have a lot, right? So large amounts dilute colored urine. So the ADH hormone is actually going to drive, you know, how much urine we excrete, how what color it's going to be, how concentrated it's going to be. Okay. All right. So that's tubular reabsorption. And you know what? We are almost to the point of the collecting duct. There's a little reabsorption that can occur there, but by the time we reach this far over, you're running out of opportunities to reclaim and reabsorb items back into those peritubular capillaries. So any reabsorption that we've talked about through the entire nephron length is going to move from the tubule system back into the peritubular capillaries, to the venule, to the cortical radiate vein, and then all the way back to that renal vein. So anything that we reabsorb here is going to follow that pathway back into the peritubular capillaries, all the way back to that renal vein. Okay? So you would think that by the time we've reached this papillary duct here in the renal pyramid, mm-hmm. that we're done. But there's a last-ditch effort to say, oh, hey, here's something else you can add to the urine. And that's what happens with tubular secretion on page 109. I do want to repeat that tubular secretion is a chance to dump items into the urine. And if you're dumping items into the urine, you're moving them from the peritubular capillaries into the filtrate. Does this sound like the same process as reabsorption or an opposite process? It is an opposite process, right? So tubular reabsorption and tubular secretion are opposite processes. You know, sometimes items get filtered and we maybe don't remove enough of the item from the bloodstream. You may recall our glomerular filtration rate is around 100 to 125 milliliters of blood plasma filtered per minute. It is not an entirely perfect job. That means that some of the items that we actually should be filtering do escape the process. So in order for us to get rid of this stuff that our body deems garbage, you have to secrete it into the filtrate. So let's take something like potassium, for instance. This is going to go way back to our very first discussion of aldosterone. You may recall that aldosterone will encourage the reabsorption of sodium in exchange for dumping out potassium. That sodium-potassium pump will do an exchange rate for us. It moves how many sodiums back into the bloodstream?
Three,
yeah, and dumps out
two
potassiums, right. So if aldosterone is present, yeah, it not only causes us to reclaim sodium, but it will also cause us to dump out and get rid of potassiums. Okay, and so I'll just make a note up here for tubular secretion. Okay, we can actually dump and get rid of those potassiums. So people with kidney damage, kidney failure, kidney disease may have difficulty excreting or secreting those potassium ions from the bloodstream into the filtrate. So those potassium ions may build up to dangerous levels in the bloodstream. Likewise, we may look at diuretics. Diuretics encourage sodium loss and water loss, and some diuretics are said to be potassium sparing. Some diuretics may in fact cause you to lose more potassium from your bloodstream. So we don't necessarily want to create an imbalance between the levels of sodium and potassium that we've got in the blood. Hydrogen ions may also be secreted, and what we mean by secretion is these items may not have been filtered, maybe they were filtered, but at any rate they're traveling in the peritubular capillaries, and now the body decides, hey, let's get rid of this, let's dump this from the peritubular capillaries into the filtrate and get rid of it. So let's take, say, hydrogen for instance. Hydrogen may have traveled from the renal artery all the way up here to the glomerulus. Maybe the hydrogens didn't get filtered, so the hydrogens continue to travel in those peritubular capillaries that wrap around this nephron. When you get over here closer to the DCT, the body may say, we probably should get rid of some of these excess hydrogens, so let's move them from the peritubular capillaries into the filtrate of the DCT. So when you hear the word, we're going to secrete those items, what does that make you think is going to happen to those items? Yes, get rid of it, dump it out, right? Okay. And so the body says, oh yeah, hey, here's some garbage, be sure and take this with your urine. So it dumps these items into the filtrate to be removed in the urine. So under what conditions might you want to increase hydrogen ion secretion?
Acidosis,
good. So if you are too acidic, you will increase hydrogen ion secretion at the DCT. That means you're dumping and getting rid of all those excess hydrogens. And at the same time that you're dumping hydrogens to remove them from your bloodstream, you may also be reabsorbing more bicarbonates. So you're getting rid of the acid and you're increasing the base. Good. So I just wanted to make a note, if you think about lab, when you talk about somebody has respiratory acidosis, and you say the general compensation is metabolic alkalosis, we say the specific compensation then is to increase bicarbonate reabsorption and to increase hydrogen ion secretion. And you got to keep in mind here that reabsorption tells us we're moving those items where? Back in the bloodstream, and secretion says we're moving those items out of the body, right? So dump it out of the bloodstream. So increasing reabsorption means you're keeping those items. Increasing secretion means you're dumping and removing those items. Let me give you a helpful hint so you don't strain your brain taking that test. If you increase reabsorption of bicarb, you're automatically going to increase secretion of hydrogens. You're going to increase both. If you decrease reabsorption of bicarbs, you automatically decrease secretion of hydrogens. So you don't have to figure out, you know, which way it goes. If you can figure out one of them, the arrows go in the same direction. So you decrease secretion and reabsorption, or you increase together. There's some causing brain cell injury, you know, making that making that work, yeah. Okay, another thing there that we may secrete from the peritubular capillaries, the bloodstream, into our filtrate to be removed is urea. And you'll notice that urea is a breakdown product of protein metabolism. So it's a normal breakdown product. We can remove it in our sweat to some extent, but that's not really the most effective way to remove urea. We do usually remove most of that in urine. Thus, the name urine comes from urea and uric acid. Uric acid comes specifically from the breakdown of RNA molecules. So So we've got protein metabolism waste product of urea. We've got an RNA or nucleic acid waste product. We're going to dump and secrete both of those items. And then creatinine is one that may be filtered, not reabsorbed, but it may also be secreted into the filtrate to be removed from the body. And I want to mention that one once again because it's a great indicator for our glomerular filtration rate. So because it's often filtered, we can at least use it as an idea of saying, hey, your kidneys are effectively functioning, or you know, maybe we can say we're looking at kidney damage or kidney disease if we're not removing enough creatinine. Likewise, we can look at blood urea nitrogen levels or BUN levels. That also gives us an indication of how effective the kidneys are at removing and secreting those items from the bloodstream. So we can use some of this waste as an indicator of how effective the kidneys are at operating.
So you say creatinine is always filtered, but what is more filtered than reabsorbed, right?
Yeah, it should be filtered, never reabsorbed.
Never?
Yep. And it may be secreted.
Okay.
So creatinine should be filtered, never reabsorbed. It may be secreted. And urea is another important one because it's mostly secreted here. So if you can't secrete, then you're probably looking at urea building up in the bloodstream, and we may have then high blood urea nitrogen levels or high BUN levels. So now that we've talked about creatinine and its secretion, let's go back to that tracing number 2. That's back on page 105. Okay, so you notice that all of these tracings start the same way. We start with creatinine traveling through the renal artery. Take us down to that glomerulus. Number 2 on the bottom of page 105, creatinine pathway. Okay, so start with renal artery, take it down to the glomerulus. So notice that we're talking about it being secreted. If it's being secreted, do we filter it here at the blood at the glomerulus? We could, but it's not reabsorbed, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we filter it, then it's going to be gone in the filtrate. So that means we've got to skip the glomerulus and keep on traveling. Where do we go after the glomerulus?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So you go from the glomerulus to the efferent arteriole. And then what happens to that creatinine at the peritubular capillaries? Secrete it. Yep, secrete it. Okay, so take it from renal artery all the way to those peritubular capillaries. From the peritubular capillaries, it is secreted into your DCT. Okay, from the DCT, you travel into the collecting duct. You know the story from here? Okay. And then in the story from here is going to take you back to the bottom of 103. And there's the rest of your pathway.
So from the after the afferent atrium?
Yes, from after the efferent, go to the peritubular capillaries. From peritubular capillaries, we secrete the item into the DCT.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm okay, I got you.
All right. Okay, so peritubular capillaries, DCT, collecting duct. If you want to include papillary duct, you can. They were dripping from the tips of the pyramids into minor calyces, major calyces, renal pelvis, ureter, urinary bladder, and urethra. So bottom of 103 will wrap that one up. What you've got left is just a couple of practice pages. I know you all have looked at the ureters, urinary bladder, and urethra in lab. I know you've looked at urine, abnormal constituents of urine. I know you've looked at things like glucosuria. Have you done the urinalysis dipstick test yet? Okay. So what's left in here is basically a repeat of that. That's pages 112 to 114. I'll just let you read that because it is a basically a repeat of most of what you've done in lab. What we'll do then is go ahead and start a little bit of fluid electrolyte today. Now, if you'd like to hear some of this or all of this again on Tuesday, we have time. Just let me know that you want to hear this stuff again. We can repeat, say, filtration, reabsorption, secretion. We can do the whole thing from the top if you want to hear it again. Okay, just remind me Tuesday. So what I'd like to do with you is get you a little bit into water and electrolyte balance. We call it fluid electrolyte balance, and that begins on page 118. Y'all want lights off, lights on, off. Y'all won't sleep on me with the heat, will you? So when we're talking about fluid electrolyte balance, we actually need to go back a little bit to early Bio-210 material and talk about fluids first and the major compartments for fluid storage. And so I hope you're with me. We're actually over a few pages on 118. We know that most of our fluids are stored inside cells. We call that the intracellular compartment. That makes up around 2/3 of our bodily fluids. The other 1/3 of our fluids are stored in an interstitial space in blood plasma and lymph. We can collectively call that fluid our extracellular fluid. Okay? So if you put this in perspective, we carry somewhere between like 25 to 27 liters of fluid inside cells. That's a lot of the fluid that we've got in our body. So we may carry upwards of about 40 liters in our entire body. Now that's a lot of fluid to be transporting around. So these fluids are primarily housed in the confines of a cell. And then we have to deal with that plasma membrane if we want to move fluids either into or out of those cells.
So that will be the third major component.
Well, let's see, fluid is inside cells, that's the 2/3, and the 1/3 is extracellular fluid.
No, I was going to say three major fluid compartments. I was trying to figure out what.
The way they write that is really funky. The first two are intracellular and extracellular. Uh-huh. They consider the plasma to be kind of like the third major compartment, but the weirdness is it's actually part of your extracellular fluid compartment.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's written poorly in that image. Water balance actually depends on your age. The younger we are, the more fluids we have. Baby's soft, supple skin is mostly water. By the time we get into our 70s and 80s, we're looking at having, say, around 50 to 60% of our bodies composed of water. You know, in comparison to a baby who may have 70 or 80% of the body composed of water. The gender also matters. Females, because of their hormones, tend to have more body fat and less water. Males, because of their hormones, tend to have more water and less body fat. So we know that testosterone and muscle is related to having more water in the body and less fatty tissue. Percent body fat also drives water composition or water content in the body. females do tend to have more fatty tissue, and so therefore they have less water. Likewise, anybody who carries more body fat is going to have less water content in their body in general. And like I mentioned, muscle tissue is going to contain a lot of water. Fat tissue does not. So the more lean muscle tissue you've got, the more water content you have in your bloodstream. So in appreciation of all of these differences, we have to be concerned about young people and old people with their fluid balance. Babies are tiny. It's easier for them to have a fluid electrolyte imbalance because their bodies are small. And likewise, older people lose their thirst mechanism and often don't drink as often as they should. So older people are more at risk for dehydration, just as young children are as well. Those who are adult-sized and between their teenage years and their, say, 60s and 70s probably have enough water to be able to manage, and they probably still have that thirst mechanism that's still operating intact. We tend to take in around 2.5 liters of fluid per day, and that's a lot of fluid, so we'll go on over to page 119. Now make sure you got your blanks there on the bottom of the page. Okay, bottom of 118. All right, so for age, water content decreases with age. Water content decreases with age. How about males compared to females?
More.
Yep. More water for males than females. For body fat, the percentage of water will decrease with the increase in body fat. Which brings up this point, you know, the Salem witch trials, which is float. Women are fat, right? We have more fat than men. Of course women float. You know, breast tissue, hips, thighs, buttocks, we have more fat than men do, so absolutely women float. Boy, they should have known that back then, right? So, yeah, witches float. Witches are women. Witches have fat. So kind of think about that full circle in terms of fat makes us float. If you're a lean, muscular body and you have a very low body fat composition, then you're not going to be able to float if you get in the water. So, you know, for those females here today, you know, if you have a boyfriend or a husband or a brother, somebody that you may go swimming with, you know, you may be able to float and he sinks like a rock, right? So that is driven by body fat composition. Fat contains no water. Muscle contains the water. So kind of an interesting concept there to think about. If they just knew stuff back in history, boy, we could save a lot of problems along the way. All right, top of page 119, let's go to water balance there. We're looking at around 2.5 liters of fluid per day being exchanged into and out of our bodies. We're not drinking 2.5 liters, and we're not peeing 2.5 liters. This is inclusive of all water routes in and all water routes out. So on average, you're looking at exchanging around 2.5 liters per day. So a lot of the water that you do get into your body is through the liquids that you drink. Your food also contains liquids. And there's a very small portion that is made through metabolism. You know, metabolism by itself is not enough to keep you alive, but you need the supplement of food and drink to maintain enough water for your body to function. We cannot live without water. In fact, we will die within about a week's time from dehydration and toxins building in our bloodstream if we don't take in enough water. We can live for a month or more without enough food. So the limiting factor for life for us is the water, not the food. We have fat supplies and protein supplies that we can pull from if needed. The thirst mechanism is what drives our need to drink. And if you think back to the brain discussion in Bio-210, what part of the brain is going to house the thirst mechanism?
No.
Hypothalamus. Yep, hypothalamus houses thirst. Good, thirst and hunger. Good. There are osmoreceptors in your hypothalamus, and they are detecting how salty your bloodstream is. And if you're salty, your hypothalamus releases ADH. It travels down into those vesicles in your posterior pituitary, And then the nerve impulse sends those vesicles of ADH out into the bloodstream. Okay, so we've kind of come full circle here with our discussion of hormones. So if you're too salty, that's going to be a stimulus for you to drink. The older we are, the more our bodies are unresponsive to that salty stimulus, and the less likely we are to actually listen to our brains and drink. So what is osmotic pressure based upon?
Sodium.
Good. And so sodium levels increasing in the bloodstream lead to an increase in osmotic pressure. That is what's going to tell those osmoreceptors in your brain to tell you to be thirsty, and you drink in response. Now, there's a second thing. Go ahead.
But what? Wait a minute. Okay.
You good?
Okay, that it would mean that would be more pulling in, right?
More pulling in, yeah. More water's going to be coming back into mm-hmm. your bloodstream if you're too salty.
Okay, so, and the BHP will be still, it'll be less pushing out, right?
Potentially, yeah. Less pushing out and more water being sucked back in the bloodstream. Yeah.
So why do you get high blood pressure?
You're too much salt. Because you not only retain water mm-hmm. from the surrounding cells and tissues, but you may in fact be thirsty to drink water. So if aldosterone is not able to maintain those levels, then you may see an increase. They actually say that if you're stressed and you increase blood pressure that way, that you may see too much sodium and water being retained by the kidneys.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to relate because I know BHP and the blood pressure is the same.
That's correct.
So we're thinking that it will be increased for the osmotic pressure and the DHP will decrease, correct?
Normally, but we will drink when we're thirsty, so that will then increase your water and your salt.
Okay, I got you.
Okay. So if you imagine having a bag of salty potato chips or some peanuts, you know, and don't drink along with it, then you feel the urge about 30 minutes later of, oh man, I gotta get something to drink because I've got all this salt in my bloodstream. And that's telling your hypothalamus that the blood is too salty and we need to dilute it down with more water. So you have two choices here. Either you'd actively drink to dilute down the saltiness of your bloodstream, or your ADH hormone will kick in and cause you to retain water. And likely it's gonna be both of those things.
That's why the blood pressure comes back.
That's right.
Okay, now I'm back. Okay.
And as long as you're too salty and ADH is acting on you, what does the urine look like?
Concentrated.
Yes. Small amounts, dark concentrated urine.
That's what they say.
What's that?
That's what they say when you drink too much
sodium. Soda, yeah, because it contains sodium. Yep, sure does. Sodas, because it contains sodium.
Yeah.
This is probably a pretty good place to pause. We'll pick back up here on Tuesday. If you guys want to hear any part of this again, let me know.
When do you stop drinking your alcohol?